This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. Kate, we're back.
We're back. Hello, everybody. Season two of the First Time Podcast.
It's very exciting to be here.
It very much is. And because last time was the first time, we're changing things up a little bit this time around.
We sure are. So last time was about the first time, but we've both had our first times now.
We're so seasoned.
We should have called this podcast First and Subsequent Times.
We should have been wordy, you know? Yeah. Wordy, less is more.
Not as catchy.
So we're going to be focusing on our second time around for our books and everything that brings, the highs and the lows. But before we get into that...
It's been a little while between times.
It has. We literally have not seen each other for like 5 or 6 weeks.
It feels like a really long time.
I know.
So, Kate, let's do the good stuff first. What's been happening? Have you read any good books?
Have I read any good books? Summer is my absolute time. It is beach camping with a whole lot of family and friends, which means above all other things that I get to ship the kids off to other people who are swimming and I get to lay in the hammock and read some books. So I did. I got through 6 books in my 2 weeks. Amazing. A few I noticed. We read the same first book of the year. Trauma Cleaner.
Trauma Cleaner is unbelievable.
Incredible. Sarah Krasnstein's book, very much awarded last year. Extraordinary book.
Yeah. It's better than The Buzz.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
I think it's really good.
Such
compassion and just eminently readable. And then I followed up with further nonfiction. I did also Chloe Hooper's The Arsonist, which is incredible. Just again, Helen Garner-like. I mean,
right.
Extraordinary.
Because The Arsonist unpacks the Black Saturday bushfires in a really specific
location.
I haven't read
it. The Churchill fires around there. Just that was completely extraordinary. And also the other one which totally rocked my world was Shell, Christina Olsen's extraordinary novel about the Opera House, the building of the Opera House and the Vietnam War and art and light and just a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful book. And I did put it on my Instagram that I am doing an early prediction that it will win the Miles Franklin. So there, I've said it.
Right. You want it on record.
Yeah, I want it on record that that is my prediction. And I also did get a cheeky early copy of Mark Brandy's The Rip because I'm doing an event with him in March and that is fabulous. Really good.
I've seen the cover. I've read the book.
His second book. So, you know, it can happen. You make a great first one and you can make a great second one.
And you can back it up.
We can do it too, right? What were you reading?
I read a lot as well. Also at the beach, we were on the south coast of New South Wales at a small town called Browley. Yeah. Shout out to all our Browley listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure there'll be any.
No, I'm sure. We're going off. Number one in Browley.
There were like, I would say, Browley has a really small population, but there were 4 of those stands where people do the book swaps.
Amazing.
Like little handmade.
Well-read people in Browley.
Yeah, amazing.
Please, if you're listening in Browley, can you get in contact with us because we would love to know that.
Well, I took a copy of Magda Zabanski's Reckoning.
Brilliant. To do a swap.
That home. Well...
Oh, no, you took
a confession.
Copy. You didn't leave.
I didn't swap because I didn't have the book with me and I intended to go back.
Oh, my gosh. So we are just going to get tons of mail about this one. Catherine Collette not swapping a book at the little library book swaps.
I know. Robbed them. So maybe I'll leave it on a train.
Yeah.
I'll leave something on a train.
Yeah.
We'll see. That'll be my payback.
Okay. So what were you reading down there? Magda Zabanski.
Well,
you
started. Okay, I've just took that. I put that in my bag. Trauma Cleaner, fabulous, as you say. I did want to say one tiny, and it's such a minor moment in the Trauma Cleaner, but you know when you just keep thinking back on a single moment?
Yeah.
And it's the most random moment. But Sarah talks about, so the book is all about Sandy.
Yeah.
Sandy. And So Sarah has followed Sandy around, and you get the impression she's gone to lots of cleaning jobs and really interviewed her and all sorts of things. But then Sarah mentions that Sandy wouldn't be able to pick Sarah from a photograph. Do you remember that moment?
Yeah.
And that Sandy wouldn't know Sarah's last name.
Yeah.
I don't know why that – I found that such a telling inclusion and not in a negative way, but just in a
– It was very revealing of Sandy's character.
Yeah, and in a totally non-judgmental way, but in such a beautiful observational
and I think that's what Sarah
of their relationship way, you know.
So incredibly, it was incredibly apt. All those little details that she put in, which meant that you get such an incredible picture of the woman.
Yeah, and so many moments in some of those cleaning jobs where you just have humour merged with darkness merged, like just...
Held it so well.
Yeah.
And that's what I think I mean for both of them when I talk about that Helen Gardner feeling, which is just this place of compassion and non-judgment. And she kind of like offers you the story, holds a bit of the trauma in it so that you don't come away completely traumatized, but are able to be part of it. It's
just
extraordinary.
Phenomenal.
So impressive.
That was a standout. Sally Rooney's Normal People, which did anyone not read that book
it
and just
totally
want
hit a nerve,
to cry for
right?
how inadequate they are? As a...
Totally hit a nerve, both in how inadequate you are as a writer compared to her, who's like 27
She's
or something,
yeah.
but also just took you right back
God.
And you knew her and you knew him and you knew that, you know, that love that got away. Oh, my goodness me.
And again, another one with tiny, like the minutiae is just so beautifully done.
So good.
Carly Finlay's Say Hello. Fabulous read.
So exciting. I cannot
really
wait to
very
read.
Very moving and very educational. One that is a very old one and a lot of people have recommended, but I only just picked up, was Stephen King's On Writing.
Ah,
it's so good.
Love it.
I say, you know,
you
18 years later. No. It's the best book on writing I've ever read.
Yes. I wouldn't call it that for me, but
I haven't read Bird by Bird. Is that your
Or Charlotte's or The Interviews?
Right. Yep.
But Bird
That's
by Bird, yes,
good.
As well. But that analogy or the metaphor he's got about the story already existing and you scraping it back, you know, like brushing really carefully and it's fully formed. It's just such a beautiful. George Saunders has got a similar one about it being glass, like the story is fully formed as a piece of glass and then the writer's job is, you know, you drop it when you get the idea and then writing the book is putting all the bits back together. And I always thought they were so in sympathy, those two ideas, that the story is fully formed and your job as the writer is just to unearth it or piece it back together.
I loved it. Yeah. It is so good. Even just, I mean, he gives this simple example of writing a, you know, starting a story and a woman goes into a house and, you know, the husband's broken out of jail or something. But he has this one line where he sort of says, she puts the kettle on. And then he sort of does these brackets of, we might come back to the kettle later, which is such a, you do that. You drop a thing and then you pick it back up, you know, if it's a significant enough thing.
He is a master. That goes really on our list, on our list of books you must have. Either someone in your writer's group needs to have it or you need to have it on your shelf.
It's really good. I even read it on Kindle. And
yeah, nice.
Yeah. And Perfect. Now I've borrowed it to read it again.
This year, one of the questions we ask in the podcast this year, will Kate finally get a Kindle?
I'm telling you, they're amazing.
No, but I just like to build more bookshelves.
No, I have to be ruthless with space. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Podcasts. Recommendations?
I listened to the Feather Heist episode of This American Life, not once but twice, because I loved
list.
It so much. Oh, heavens. It's just the most extraordinary story. You've got to listen to it.
The superintendent done by This American Life is my number one.
Oh, my
this
gosh. American okay,
Life.
I'm going to do
so
that.
So good.
Also, the library one. I mean, obviously for bookish people and writers is amazing, but the library one, which maybe is called The Room of Requirement, which is This American Life, also fabulous episode. And the other one that I listened to a few of was actually a recommendation by a previous guest, Penny Russin, is Nina LeCur's Keeping a Notebook, which is for writers and on creativity. Nina is a writer herself, Canadian, I think. And they're quite short, I think 12 or 15 minutes, exercises and things for creativity. So that's a good one
good
I recommend
one.
For the writers. What about you?
I binged on So You Want to Be a Writer, which is by the ACT Writers Centre.
Yes.
They have a massive back catalogue, which I just listened and listened and listened and listened.
Fantastic.
It was really good. Pamela Hart, I like the ones, I think Pamela Hart is in two.
Okay.
She must be the creative director or something of the Australian Writers Centre, but it's really interesting.
I need to go back and listen to those as well. Also, I have to, on things that were in our ears, I must give a shout out to Jessica Townsend's Nevermore, or the second one, Wondersmith, on the audiobook, which we listen to get our kids to and from our very remote camping location. Just an extraordinary audiobook. I mean, it's a fabulous book and that's all wonderful, but just the quality of the audiobook is really astounding. And our whole family...
That's a keeper.
We're totally into it. So, yeah, I like giving a shout out to those ones too.
My kids are into The Magic Faraway Tree at the moment. I loved it as a kid.
Yeah.
I do not believe it has stood the test of time.
Really?
I find it very difficult to read.
Are you reading it or audiobooking
it? I'm reading it, but I just found out, I think Sophie Dahl does the audio.
And also, oh gosh, did we have one? I think it was Kate Winslet, and that's wonderful.
Oh, maybe it's Kate Winslet.
Yeah,
maybe
she's wonderful. She's wonderful.
Yes. The audiobook I've been listening to, which I've mentioned to you before, is, I keep picking it up and putting it down, is The Secret by Rhonda Byrne.
You love The Secret.
Well, look, The Secret has a lot of issues. But The Secret, I mean, people will have probably heard of The Secret. It's based on the law of attraction, and you just, basically you visualize a lot of great things happening to you. And
you used it. You used it last year.
Yeah, totally. I was totally into it. To the point where I reckon, well, I did. I didn't listen to it for ages. And then I picked it up and I was like visualizing and just acting as though, all this money is going to come to me and all this great stuff's going to come to me. And then I went to work and I won this raffle that had a cash prize, which was phenomenal.
I love it.
That was on a Friday. And then I was like, oh, it's great. It's amazing. But I didn't really do anything interesting with the cash prize, even though it was a good, I mean, why we speak, this is a terrible tale.
Anyway,
went on bills and boring stuff like that. So then on the weekend I was thinking, maybe it would be better to win like a prize, because then you would do something, you would be locked in. It wouldn't just go
so
into
you put
the
it out
boring
to the
bubble.
Universe.
So I put it into the universe. I was like, I'm going to win another prize. I'm just going to win a prize. And so that... I was thinking that over the weekend, and then on the Monday I went in and I won another raffle.
You are not serious.
I am not.
The people
kidding you.
At
First
your work
prize.
Must hate you.
Pretty much, but I think it's my personality. So this second prize was a night at Crown Casino.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Talking about The Secret though.
Yep.
Let's put it out there. Okay. This season is all about our second time. What are we actually planning to do ourselves? This
What's
year.
What's going to happen?
What's going to happen with our writing? You go first.
I was trying to slip in to get you to go first. Okay, so I'm going to finish the second draft, or the draft that I'm working on, of my second novel.
Great.
And I'm going to enjoy the process that's bundled together.
Love it.
So it's not just finishing, it's going to be a really phenomenal
Great.
Read. I'm also, and I'm sure we'll talk about this across the season, the premise of my second novel is it is set in Toastmasters clubs. People might have heard of Toastmasters. It's a public speaking club, very weird and wonderful world. But the book is all about a number of characters who progress to the national Toastmasters final. So as a form of action research for the novel, I've been competing in Toastmasters competitions.
And doing very well, might we say.
I should say there are not a lot of people competing.
No, you shouldn't say that. You don't give away those bits. You just say that you are an award winner, award-winning Toastmaster. Toastmaster champion? What you say?
Well, they give disproportionately large trophies. So you win at your club level and almost
trophies.
No one is there. Yeah, and you will get a trophy that is – I've taken to awarding it to my children as the best cleaner of the day. But it could be 30 or 40 centimetre tall trophy.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
So
you're going.
So I've progressed through two rounds and I need to win the next round to get to the national final sort of.
You're using
scenario.
The secret for this too, right?
Yeah.
Hells yeah. And you're actually doing some travel for this.
Yeah. Well, I'll also go only as an observer to the international final in Denver, Colorado this year.
Ooh, yeah. Does this happen to coincide with the release of the Helpline in the US?
It will be around the same time.
Perfect.
Yeah. So that's
so we will
super
bring
exciting
something up to the minute, you know, updates.
I'm gonna
on the podcast.
Up an accent in
yeah,
the...
please do. From on location in the States. Okay, so right. Second draft,
Toastmasters draft of second book,
Toastmasters.
And then I want to work on a script.
Ooh, a script for?
A mockumentary script.
Love it.
Yeah, so that's what I'll be doing this year.
Okay.
Now, the pressure's on.
The pressure's on. So I have got lots of balls up in the air at the moment. I am going to finish the, you know, 17th draft of my second novel very, very soon. And I am going to get myself an agent to put that one out into the world because it's time. It's
so
time
all our
to do
agent
that.
Listeners.
Yes, absolutely. If you're an agent and you're interested in repping my second novel, do get in contact. I've also got a picture book draft and a middle grade novel that I'm working on. So I want some time to keep working on those. And by the end of this year, I'm just desperate to get onto my third adult novel. So I want to have,
wow.
I will have started that.
So you could have three books in the world, three books this year at a stage, picture book early.
Really
years.
Hoping to, yeah. And I'm quite enjoying, I think I've said before on the podcast, you know, I'm like big into immersion and like diving into the one thing. But I've been working on my second novel for, you know, three years now. I'm really ready to finish it. I'm glad I've had this long because it's morphed into an entirely different thing than it started out as. But I've also really enjoyed having the two other projects on
yeah.
the go, like being able to move between, and the podcast as well,
yeah.
Which is fantastic. And earning some money. My two.
What is this
we're thing?
Just surviving on raffles
money.
Now?
So my second child goes to school this year, which was always the kind of the line in the sand of when, you know, proper work comes back. So how do I make this work, the proper work? We will find out.
Food for thought.
This season, we also have a whole lot of amazing guests. We're starting off with six guests that we're recording in Melbourne, and we'll keep you up to date with what happens after that. But our very first guest is debut novelist and fellow podcaster, JP Pomari. And we recorded this interview at the very end of last year before JP's incredible debut, Call Me Evie, actually hit the shelves. So you get all of the pre-release anxiety and nerves in his voice. It's a very generous and open interview, and we hope you enjoy. Well, we're so thrilled to welcome Melbourne writer JP Pomari to The First Time. JP grew up on a horse racing farm in small town New Zealand. Now based in Melbourne and Clunes, he is a writer and podcaster with a marketing background. His work's been widely published in journals including Mianjin, Kill Your Darlings, TLB Review of Books, and the New Zealand Listener. He's also won and been shortlisted for a number of prizes. His debut novel, Call Me Evie, is released in Australia and the UK in January 2019, and the US and a whole lot of other territories later in the year. Welcome, JP.
Thank you.
And congratulations on Call Me Evie.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that I got an early copy because we're actually interviewing you before its release into the world.
Yeah, no, this is it's exciting. This is one of my first sort of media obligations.
I'm so glad because
I'm
was
not that polished.
Not that polished. This is a man who's got his own podcast, the On Writing Podcast. And to give a little backstory, JP actually interviewed me as one of my very first
That's
media
right.
engagements when Skylarkin came out. So it is a little surreal to have you here
yeah.
in this
no,
position.
Exciting.
But I'm so glad. I want to go right back to begin because this is all about first time. So I want to ask you about the first time you were ever published.
So I think, I mean, it's tricky because you sort of consider yourself published in print, but I had stuff online.
Yep, sure.
But the first time I was published in print, to be honest, it was actually in the New Zealand Herald when I was at high school. It was like...
Tell us.
It was something about a high school ball. I almost forgot about it. I was just like, I was going to go with Mianjin, which was like my first fiction published. But my first sort of article was, I would have been probably 16.
Yeah.
And they have what's called the College Herald, or the Head. I don't know if they still do it. And you get paid $100.
Oh, my gosh.
When you're 16, like, it's pretty exciting.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, it was just a story about going to the ball and, I don't know, it was kind of like, I would hate to read it now, but it was
pretty
exciting.
Cut out a copy?
It was on my dad's fridge for years, but I doubt it's still there.
And what did it feel like to see it?
At that stage, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I think journalism or sort of media was definitely at the back of my mind. But 16, you got lots on your mind, of course. So,
absolutely.
So, yeah, it was surreal and exciting, and it was good to see my teachers and, like, dad and stuff proud of me. But at the same time, I got sort of lots of feedback and stuff before it went to the College Herald. So I wasn't, like, I felt like it was a team effort a little bit. I don't know. They're saying sort of...
Which is so much of writing is.
Yeah, really. But I think having adult pieces published... but having pieces published that haven't been largely edited that I've sort of produced myself was that feeling was a lot more exciting. And I think with Mianjin, when I got the news that Mianjin had picked up a short story, that was about the same time I had a pitch accepted at Kill Your Darlings, and everything sort of started to happen at once. I think I may have begun correspondence with who would become my agent, I'm not sure, but everything sort of happened all at once, and I was away on my honeymoon. Like, I just got married. It was a great, good year.
Yeah, I'm going to say, really good that year. Sounds like a great year.
And we were up, one of my wife's friends has a house in Noosa, and as a wedding present, she said, go away and start there. And we hadn't actually organised anything for our honeymoon, so we're like, cool, that's great.
Let's do that.
We went and stayed up in the gigantic house in Noosa, and we were having champagne, and then I got, like, this email, and I was like, I saw Mianjin, I'm like, oh, cool, rejection. And then I opened it, and I was like, oh, my God. And then, so it was a really cool feeling.
And was this for The Grief Code?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, which is... beautiful piece. I reread it this week in preparing to talk to you. And I wanted to ask about those discrete pieces of short fiction and how you've managed to distribute your writing energy, I suppose, because you were working in marketing for quite a time as well.
I mean, this is something I've sort of written about and thought about a lot. I think there's two things to unpack there. The first thing is working in a really non-creative field of marketing for my brother, a reasonably flexible boss. I didn't find I was sort of drained intellectually, so I could go home and write, and I had no problems with that. And I was writing until really late at night and before I got to work, and at work if I could. So I think there's definitely a distinction to be made with, like, if you were a full-time copywriter, for instance, or something that sort of demanded quite a bit of intellectual energy. And the second part of that was, I guess, distributing them. I just pitched really widely. I was fully aware of the realities of publishing and what publishers look at. And I know certain publications, they have this reputation where they only print quality stuff. And so I didn't know I was writing crap, but I was pitching all these great publications, hoping to get it in. And if you knock on the door long enough, someone's going to let you in. And I think the most exciting thing about that short period where the ball started to roll was I'd been pitching for years and sending into short story competitions. And
with little bits of success along the way to give you a taste
tiny,
to keep
teeny,
going.
Tiny, yeah. So, yeah. Like, as soon as a publication would start up, you know, like, everyone gets their degree and goes, I'm going to start a literary magazine.
Yeah.
Completely oblivious to the realities of the cost to run a lit magazine. And obviously, you know, like, there's definitely success stories. Like Kill Your Darlings, for instance, was sort of a project, you know, immediately out of university, I believe. But then there were loads of ones that sort of didn't last as long. But I was pitching these guys because I was like, they're not getting that many submissions. So there was a couple of small, really small publications that picked up pieces here and there. You'll never find them on my bio because they're probably not around anymore.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
But I was just looking at, I was at first sort of playing the odds. It's just that thing, you know, I think people do pay attention to whether or not you're pre-qualified. Like, they have a look and say, well, this person had, you know, it's worth reading. At
if
the very
they've already
least.
Been published in yeah. one of those journals.
Yeah. So then, you know, and it's like most of them were unpaid really early on. Lots of stuff online, that sort of thing. But as soon as you get like three reasonably anonymous sort of, you know, publications under your belt, then all of a sudden I felt more confident pitching.
Sure.
You know, Lift a Brow and Kill Your Darlings, Mianjin and Southerly and so on and so forth.
And you sound like you really were across the kind of literary landscape.
Yeah.
Whereas we've talked to some writers, and I'm thinking about Mel Cheng and Claire Coleman in particular in season one, who kind of felt like they didn't know anyone in the industry. They didn't have any way in. They didn't know the network. You, of course, have been running the On Writing podcast as well for 3 years?
Yeah, coming up 3 years. Yeah.
So what, A, how did you get into that? How did you decide to do it? And B, what kind of lessons did you learn from that in the way that you were pitching and going forward with your manuscript?
The one thing, you know, it's impossible to isolate any penny drop moment, you know, like, I've spoken to some like incredible writers, but the best advice I ever got wasn't from like Joyce Carol Oates or, you know, AJ Finn or anyone. The best advice I always seemed to get was from debut novels, which is what's so exciting about, you know, the first time podcast, because, you know, Joyce Carol Oates, for instance, I doubt she can remember the struggle of trying to get published.
The like, exquisite pain of it.
Yeah, in some ways, she's probably aware she went through that. But I don't know, she's been publishing for, like, what, 50 years?
Yeah.
So, like, her advice was really not necessarily sophisticated, but really quite sort of general.
Yeah.
It was more what you're likely to hear in a sort of creative writing course, as opposed to someone who's, you know, been just busting their ass trying to get published. So the one thing that always comes to mind whenever someone asks me that question is you need to be, well, certainly I wasn't aware of the realities of the publishing industry. And it's just seems like this, you know, really inaccessible place, but it's not. It seems like, you know, it seems like you have to be extraordinarily lucky to get invited to the party.
Yeah.
Absolutely, there is an element of luck. Like, I was extremely lucky in the way I managed to secure representation. But in saying that, there's absolutely pragmatic steps you can take along the way. Slush pile success stories, for every one of those, there's dozens of people who just kept at it, who just did everything they could. And the fact of the matter is you're never aware of where you're at in the process. We spoke about this briefly off air, but when I was, by the time this airs, the prize is probably announced. So,
yeah, nice.
But I was helping judge the Vic Premier's Unpublished Manuscript Award. And coming from like someone who did really struggle and who worked really hard to get published, I was reading lots of entries thinking, you're so close. You'll never know how close you are.
Oh, gosh.
And so I contacted the Wheeler Center and said, would it be all right if I contacted some of these stories, some of these authors of the stories here that I really loved, just to say, you know, I really loved your story, because it's that validation and you never know how close you are.
Did they say okay?
Yeah, basically.
Oh, good.
So, I mean, I think the one thing I would say that I've learnt, and it's just a collection of, you know, anecdotes and little insights from authors, is the only way you can get there really, other than, you know, enormous amounts of luck, is to, one, stick at it, but two, just keep making progress, little steps, just do everything you can to kind of develop as a writer, but also to start getting feedback and to just immerse yourself in the community. It's the easiest and probably the most direct way, I think.
Mm. So, JP, you have this kind of idea in your head about this pragmatic way to get in. You're putting things out there, you're pitching. Had you been writing the manuscript that became Call Me Evie that whole time?
Yeah, there's a funny story behind Call Me Evie. So I had written a couple of practice manuscripts. But
I love it when people call them practice manuscripts.
Yeah, they're
easy to say in retrospect.
There was never, I had no intention of trying to publish them, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I had no intention of going back. And this is only one or two times. I would write 50,000 words aping a writer I'd admired. So someone like Murakami, Cormac McCarthy at the time, which is just like no one would ever publish it anyway. But I just basically took their stories and rewrote them.
Yeah.
And that was an exercise in understanding the mechanics of plot. I was aping their voice. That's the last thing a publisher wants. But also, I think in a way, you kind of find your own voice doing that. So I sort of just wrote these things. I spent 30 days in Thailand and wrote like a couple thousand words every day.
Yeah,
and
wow.
And then at the end of it, I had like 60, 70,000 words. And it was trash, and I'll never, ever look at it again. But I also...
Did you keep it?
I think that laptop broke.
Oh, I was going to say, that's going to be worth a lot of money one day. I
never pulled anything off. And then I go, okay, cool, I'm ready. So I started, I go, cool, I've got a plan for the story. And if anything, it was probably YA at the beginning anyway. And I go, okay, I'm going to write it. I'm going to write this novel. This is the one. But you know when you're writing and you reread and you go, this isn't like novels. You know, like... This isn't, there's something about it that doesn't seem like a novel, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like a published novel, I mean. So when you're reading it, you're like, I know I'm not there, but I don't know why. And so I was editing and editing and it's just, you know.
So editing as you went, or you got down a first draft?
No, I put down a first draft and then I'd go back through. And I'm editing and editing. And like I said, it's just, every time I read it, I'm like, my prose isn't good enough. And I was kind of aware of that. And then that laptop blew up. This has happened like three times. So the laptop blew up and I lost that manuscript.
The whole thing?
Yeah, the whole thing.
No backup. Let this be our community service announcement to all the writers out there to back up your work.
Yeah, I've lost lots of work not backing up. I do it now. But I was like, you know what? It's good. Start again, completely fresh. So that disappeared. And I go, and like devastated for a couple of days. Got the laptop fixed, couldn't recover it. So anyway, I went away and I go, it was never good enough. You're deluded, you fool yourself. Go just like write some short stories, get some feedback. So then I sort of really focused on writing short stories and stuff. And that's when I started to get some sort of validation from people within the industry.
Okay, yep.
I was getting feedback. I sensed I was getting closer. And then I thought about, I had this idea for a story. It was really, I hadn't figured it out. It was completely uncharted for me. I was like, just start with this. And so I went away and started with that. I knew I wanted to write about Makatu.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I had this character, Kate, who's probably a bit of a hangover. If I took anything from that first attempt at a novel, I think
was
Kate...
the character.
Yeah, yep. Kate was really close to... what I was writing about in the YA novel. But I think because she'd stayed with me so long and I knew her so well, I felt like she'd grown, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
You know, so I felt like, it's like if you meet someone and you hang out with them for a while, but you never have a serious or deep conversation. You feel like you know them, but then all of a sudden... you get drunk or something and then all of a sudden something comes out and you're like, okay. And it unlocks.
Now I get it.
Yeah. So I feel like as I grew as a writer and Kate was always there, she kind of changed and something unlocked. And then, so I put her in Makatu basically.
So character plus place. See what happens.
Definitely setting before. I mean, I was just lucky that I had Kate.
Yeah.
You know, it was setting first and foremost, and then something was going to happen there.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure what. And I go, what happens if I put Kate, who lives in Melbourne, comes from like a kind of upper middle class background, who's never really left the city, who's sort of, you know, private school. What happens if I sort of just put her in Makatu? Then what? And so that's where the story sort of grew from. I just knew I had two things, and I was like, how can I make these guys work together.
And for readers who have not yet had the pleasure of reading Call Me Evie, a lot of things happen when Kate gets put in Makatu. Okay, so you're writing, you get down this manuscript and then you sent it to the Unpublished Manuscript Award for KYD. Was that the first place you submitted it?
More or less, you know, a really undercooked version of this novel did go in the Vic premieres, which is what I've just judged. So it's really funny. My wife reminds me, he's like, do you feel weird judging it considering you weren't even like highly commended? I'm like, don't say that. But
okay, so you'd put it out to that?
Yeah, that was way too early. I think it was the Jane Harper year, maybe the year after.
It's a tough year.
Whatever year it was, no, I think it was the year after. But whatever year it was like this, it was a crime novel trying to be a literary novel.
Yep.
it was meandering and huge and gross. And I actually look, I'm embarrassed about it. Because
which is how we always feel about earlier drafts.
You're just really ambitious. Like you threw it in. And you know what? Like a judge might have gone, read the first couple of pages, oh, this isn't bad. And then read a couple more and gone, oh, this is terrible. But they might have had that impulse I had to say, you know, there's possibly something here.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, I didn't get that feedback. But I...
But you obviously believed in it enough to keep working on it then.
Yeah.
You didn't chuck
it
in the towel.
And it's funny, these competitions, because as a writer, they mean so much. They mean the world, and you're like, I'm going to win this, and then I'm going to be a superstar, or whatever. You know, like, these competitions let you imagine a life where you are a novelist. Yeah. They let you
and
imagine.
And you have to have a certain amount of ego and ambition to even get the words down on the page and to submit.
Yeah, and that sort of belief. So, yeah, I had entered that. I knew from the podcast and from other writers, and just like being just a tiny bit savvy about the industry, that you, with lots of publishers, you only get one bite of the cherry.
Yeah.
And so I said, sure, a unpublished manuscript prize is a little bit like a lotto ticket, you know, like I might work on it for a decade and still not win. Whereas publishers, if I send it now, in 10 years' time, I can send it again, possibly.
Yeah.
But certainly not a year later. Like, you know,
if
a publisher gives it a chance and decides against it, I think it's really hard to get them to read it again.
Yeah. So you want it to be right for the publishers. So how long then did you work on it?
In total, probably about, I mean, it's hard to say. In retrospect, I wish I recorded the date, because I actually get this question a lot. I think 2019, 2018?
Yeah.
I think it was about 2014, I think. It was about... Yeah. So I got picked up after about 3 years of working on it, 3.5 years.
Yeah.
As in I got an agent. And then a year and a half later, the books come out. It's probably been a journey of about 5 years.
So after this one, more work, then KYD, then agent.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell us how that happened.
So it had been entered in other prizes, but I think on my behalf, so the Ritual Prize I'd entered.
Yeah.
And my agent said, contact me, said, no, pull it out, basically. So so with Kill Your Darlings, there's no, you're not bound to any publisher and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Agents always want your book to receive multiple offers.
Yeah.
And that can't happen if publisher has first pass.
Sure.
Writer first pass. So, so I think I entered the Ritual Prize thinking I'd love to be published. I never dreamed that more than one publisher might be interested.
Yeah.
So I was working closely with my agent for months, and the manuscript that Kill Your Darlings got compared to the manuscript that publishers eventually got was just like, it was completely different. As in, I'd cut so much. The whole entire story had changed. They got what was closer to the Vic Premier's iteration. They got like a sort of jumbled mess.
Yeah.
Whereas me and Pip had worked through it so much. And honestly, like, if I look back at what she got, I can't even imagine what she saw in it. I think she's like a genius. Like,
so you submit to Pippa. This is Pippa Masson at Curtis Brown.
Yeah.
And she takes it on and then works with you.
So, I mean, when I say I can't see what she, it's no exaggeration. There's no way I'd be published without it. Like, absolutely no way.
That's amazing. That's an amazing relationship with an agent.
Yeah. She, you know, I think I'm such a sort of people pleaser that anything she said, I'd do. Like, I'd, like, sense of artistic integrity out the window. I just trusted her from the moment we sort of started emailing. And so...
Because she saw... Sorry to interrupt. She saw... she had a vision for the book that aligned with what you... Your ambition for
it. I should have reread that. Like, I think her first response, I was like, hey, I've been published here and whatever. I've got a novel manuscript and I'm seeking representation. You sort of standard query. And she said, yeah, great. And I think because she had cut down 4 days a week, and I think she sort of said, oh, I'm not necessarily taking on writers at the moment, but I'd be interested to read the first few chapters and a synopsis. And so you're like, oh my God. All of a sudden you're like, I was really stressed. I was like, what do I do? So I went and just polished, can I swear?
Yeah.
I polished the shit out of the first three chapters. And then I submitted them with a synopsis. And she emailed back, oh, there's a few red flags. It looks okay. I'd be interested to see the rest of it. I'm like, oh, my God, now I have to polish the whole thing. So I went away and just like...
Well, how long? How long is this time period like?
Like, I mean, like a few months, I think.
Yep.
So she had it for a few months. And then she came back with that and I'm like, sent to my wife. I'm like, what do I do? So I just like polished it as much as possible. But I wasn't thinking structural. I wasn't thinking what's wrong with the story. I'm thinking what's wrong with the writing.
Yeah.
So I was just basically looking at a sentence level, like tightening things up, sent it off. And then she emailed back going, I think, I can't remember exact language. Basically, I think it has legs. There's so much to do. Would you want to chat on the phone? So then I was like, had a phone call with her and one of her colleagues, a reader with Curtis Brown. And they basically like went through everything. And I was like...
And was this exciting, devastating?
Exciting. Yeah, okay. Very exciting. And I was thinking, at the very least, I wasn't thinking she's going to represent me, although you're hoping that the whole time. At the very least, I'm getting this insight from the industry.
Sure.
And I was just like consuming it. Like I was hungry for... I think the first phone call, I kept them on the line for like an hour and a half. Like, what else? What can I do? And so, you know, I just took everything they gave to me, and I just tore the thing apart, just cut wholesale changes, pulled everything out, did everything I could to sort of tidy it up and align close to their vision of the book. Because as I said, I just trusted her so much from day one. And then sent her away. She goes, yeah, it's really close. I've attached a contract for representation, and here's some more notes. And I was like, okay. And I was like, I was over the moon. And I had worked really hard on it. And I was, so in this time between that first draft, second draft, and when I got the contract, I had sent it to competitions.
Yeah, right.
I had coincidentally been queried by a publisher.
Yeah, okay.
So everything was like, I'm like, okay, it's all good.
It's happening.
It's fine. I'm on top of things, but also internally like screaming because I'm like, you know, there's so much happening at once. And Kill Your Darlings and The Ritual Prize were the two things I submitted it to. And I told her, and she goes, oh, okay, The Ritual one might be a bit tricky. Kill Your Darlings, perfectly fine. But that was the manuscript they got. And then I went away and changed the entire thing. And then, so she gave me some more changes, went and basically actioned that. And she'd got another reader on board, Ben Stevenson, I think his name is, who wrote Green Light.
Yeah, fantastic.
So obviously a really good, you know, great insight, and even his feedback was incredible. So I just kept working, and then Pippa goes, okay, one more polish, and then I think we're ready to send it out. I think she said I have contacted Hashed or something because they run the Ritual Prize. Is it the Ritual or a show?
I'm never sure.
Okay.
But we'll put a link.
Anyway, I was like, okay, cool, polished it up, and then she goes, cool, I think it's ready. And then with an agent, you've got, I was recently asked, you know, what's the benefit of an agent? What do they really do? Can't you do all this stuff yourself? I'm like, you can, but you can never get like every Australian publisher to take you seriously all at once. You can never make yourself a priority to them. It's incredibly difficult unless you're like a celebrity or something. So the access that Pippa has to the industry is just incredible. And so she sent it out to not everyone, but to publishers she thought would be a good fit. And then we got a like incredible response, and then it's
and so to answer that question, really, I mean, you've done it so well in explaining the process, is that your agent A gave you this incredible period of feedback where you really worked up the manuscript again from what you'd done yourself, and then did the industry stuff of getting you this incredible deal into how many international territories you got.
So it's been published in English and distributed, I don't know where.
All the places.
But the big...
UK, US.
I think UK are distributing to, I don't know where. But it's in, it's only in English at the moment. So we're waiting to see what happens.
But, you know, extraordinary buzz about it too. Like some pretty
I think
impressive.
Hachette's done so much heavy lifting for the buzz because the US isn't till March. The UK's hardcover first. So the paperback, I feel like that's where they try. I mean, they're doing a wonderful job, but I feel like it's Kindle and hardcover, and then the paperback seems to be where they try to get lots of sales.
I wanted to ask, because I'm not across your area of expertise in marketing, but I wanted to get, in terms of a marketing publicity perspective, and you've spoken to so many writers, you know, what the writers tend to do wrong? What do publishing houses do right? You know, where do you see it really working for books and authors?
I think, so it depends what your ambition is, you know. Some people want to publish a book.
Yep.
fine. You know, there's all sorts of ways to go. If you really wanted, you can publish it yourself.
Yeah.
If that's your ambition, great. Some people want to publish a book with the chance of critical acclaim. Great. I'm probably not the person to speak to.
Yeah.
I can sort of say what worked for me, but some people have an ambition to make a career as a writer. If that's your sort of sole focus, that's probably more of what I was approaching the industry to do.
Yep.
I definitely absolutely have ambitions to write something that's critically acclaimed and loved by critics as much as readers or whatever.
Can't necessarily do both.
Yeah, it's not, few people can do both. And so I thought this was more in the editing process than the writing process. But I definitely had an eye for what sells, what publishers want. I think it's naive to think that if you want a, like I said, I wanted a career as a writer. And I think if you want a career as a novelist, so not writing for magazines or newspapers or anything, just purely as a novelist, you have to be really savvy to the realities of the industry and the commercial side of the industry. So I wrote largely for the market.
Yep.
It started off as a really literary novel, and which is surprising to some. And I edited for the market. I edited in a way that I wanted to make it more appealing to a broader audience. And I've spoken to my publishers in all territories and said, you know, like, I do want to pivot at some stage, or I do want to possibly explore other things. But to set myself up as a novelist, I think I approached in a way where it's the commercial viability's covered first. I want to write beautifully. I want to write. I want to commit to the art form as a medium for expressing deeper emotions and having beautiful language and poetry and so on and so forth. Absolutely, I want to do that. But I first and foremost, I want to put food on the table. I want to make sure I'm not working so much in a job away from writing that I don't feel like I'm a novelist, if that makes sense.
It does. It's really good. There was something in one of your bios that I read that says you began as a literary novel lover, but you've moved to, fast paced, smart thrillers. And I loved your interview with AJ Finn, who wrote Woman at the Window, which I've just finished reading too. And I can see, people are doing comparisons and things, and I can see, not just because I'm assuming Call Me If He's also going to be a smash hit. But do you set your goals and say, okay, I want it to be a little bit AJ Finn? I mean, I know obviously you weren't looking at that when you were writing, but, I'm pitching and I'm following these people as influences.
Yeah, it's not conscious. I think I put a question to AJ that I think he didn't like that much. Did you plan, or was this sort of designed? Did you see the sales in you because you're in the industry?
Yeah.
And, I think I can't remember his response, but if I'm going to sort of poorly paraphrase, if you want to write just purely to make money or to sort of get into the industry, you're not going to make it. Because everyone says trends and things change so much, and the psychological suspense novel, it's really saturated the market.
Yeah.
There needs to be something a bit more authentic about it as well. I know I've just harped on about, writing to make a career out of it, but I need to make the distinction. That's not writing purely to make as much money as possible, because you're not writing what you love. You're not going to enjoy it. So there has to be some authenticity in your approach. I think it's the editing process where you can be a bit more sort of, savvy to the market.
And that's taking on the feedback from your agent publishers
and
as
that's
well.
I've got a friend who's going through the process at the moment. A lot more like integrity than I have. probably needs the money less as well, I'll be honest. But they are having real trouble with the editors and their agent purely, and I won't name names, but purely because they've got a very specific vision for the book.
Yeah.
And the publisher and the agent have both invested a lot of time and a lot of money. And it's a sort of arm wrestle where me, I've got like a rubber arm. I'm like,
do whatever you want.
Do we need to do to engage more readers, basically?
And certainly it seems like a time in the industry where, it's hard. It can be really hard to sell books, and it can be really hard to sell really, really good books. And so your publisher and your agent, I suppose in a lot of ways are trying to tell you the best way to make it work.
And you're not competing with other books.
Yeah.
you're competing with iPhones, Twitter, you're competing with like everything else. And we're so, particularly in Australia, like sports gets so much funding, and it's like, it's just so such a part of the Australian psyche that people watch, you know, 5 hours of football every weekend. People aren't picking up books as much. So I write in a way that I'm like, where is the reader putting the book down and picking the phone up? What can I do to stop that from happening? Basically, I'm thinking.
Nice.
So my wife's like my first reader, and her mum, and they are. My wife's probably like a 20 book a year kind of read, like a couple of months, and her mum's probably like a 10 book a year kind of reader. And I'm always thinking, I'm competing with distractions. Where are they getting distracted? Where am I losing them?
Are you sitting in the corner, JP, taking notes, watching
I just creepily like stare at her while she's reading and watch her eyes sort of deviate from the book. And then I'll be like, what part are you on? No, it's not that. I am neurotic, but I'm not that.
Yeah, okay. Nice.
But I ask it, you know, where does it drag? Where does it slow down? And, you know, your publisher and agent are going to point these things out as well. But I'm particularly conscious of, as I said, I wanted to write something people started and then they finished.
Yeah, and it is incredibly difficult to put it down.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just like so much, it's just feedback, of course, because you are so close to it. You're like, I love this. This is so good. You need really high quality feedback. And I think I get that definitely from my wife, but of course from my agent and publisher as well.
JP, it's a bit of a privilege to be speaking to you before the book comes out. And, you know, a lot of the feedback we've got from season one is about the honesty and the candor in which people spoke about all their feelings. So at the risk of making you feel completely uncomfortable,
No.
What kinds of things are you looking forward to about the book being released? What are you terrified about?
I'm terrified of the Saturday paper.
Everyone's terrified of the Saturday paper.
You know what? I really don't care that much. And the reason being is I think the measure for me is people don't hate it and it sells well. And that's because I've become less ambitious about it. You know, at one stage I'm like, I want critics to love it and I want it to sell well. I have become less ambitious about it. I have sort of moved beyond those feelings of apprehension about reviews. I oscillate between like crippling self-doubt and this is totally typical, I'm sure.
Yeah, I was going to say pretty normal.
Crippling self-doubt and like overwhelming excitement. But I think the main feeling at this very point in time, and we're like still 3 weeks away from publication, is just like a kind of low-level excitement and relief. Relief that we have had some early reviews and responses. Relief that we're getting
your Goodreads ratings looking pretty good.
Yeah, like, I mean, like the thing about that, I hate Goodreads, but the thing about that is books before they come out have great ratings because they're like all the early readers. Like I've given like so many of my friends a copy, and of course they're going to give it 5 stars.
Yeah.
I'm sure that thing will be in free fall like in a few weeks, but it's also I check that and I'm going to stop checking it. But it's also, you know, there's like you don't know how you're going to wake up feeling about it the next day, but the last sort of week it's just been relief because, as I said, we don't know what's going to happen with the Saturday paper, but it's from booksellers. The response has been reasonably solid. Hachette, my publisher, has put so much behind it. As someone who does receive advanced copies of books, who is hearing from publicists and stuff like that, I know for a fact they've just thrown everything behind it, which is just like the most incredible feeling.
So, and can you say what that looks like, JP? Because for people listening, I suppose they're like, what does it look like when a publisher throws everything behind it? Is it, you know, lollies that come out with the book? Is it, taking you around to visit stores? What does it look like?
You know, the main thing is, you know, like, I don't want to say this is overly important because there's like, this is quite a privileged sort of experience. It doesn't happen for everyone that gets their book published. And at the same time, it doesn't guarantee success.
No.
So there's that to be said. First and foremost, it's not going to happen for everyone, but it's great when it does, but it doesn't necessarily mean the world.
Yeah.
So basically like things, so they'll get you to conferences. So I've been to like a few booksellers conferences where I've been fortunate enough to speak. So there's the independent like book buyers group. I can't remember what they're called.
Yeah.
Like QBD. Like even getting to like Booktopia and doing signings and doing their podcasts and stuff. So it's called The Long Tail, like leading up to the book coming out. So much pre-publication marketing happens. And all you're doing is being marketed to booksellers.
Because they're the ones who are going to be putting your book in people's hands.
You want to hand sell it. But then there's the big commercial chains, so QBD, Dimmicks and stuff like that. So just all they're doing is trying to get you to meet them. There's also how many proofs they sent out. So I think there was a couple of thousand went out to reviewers, bloggers.
Was that terrifying?
Yeah, it is. It is. Because that's the first time. That's the first time you know people are reading it.
And you're just terrified that someone's going to see a typo in the third page.
Which happened. But you're also, while all this is happening, you're getting feedback about social media.
Yeah. So tell us your plan for social media.
Well, my wife's in charge now. I wanted to mention that because it's
awesome. Like, everybody get a wife to be in charge
and
of
like
your social media.
The perfect reader, right? So the funny thing about social media, I find it, I don't have any serious mental health issues. I'm clearly very neurotic. I have like occasional sort of manic episodes, but generally I'm on top of things. Social media, like however I'm feeling, will amplify that. And it's really, I think it's really unhealthy for writers to spend a lot of time on social media. I think you can, one, it's a distraction, but two, you can be distracted by the wrong things. So like reviews and stuff for your book. So someone posts something good, you feel so excited. But your feelings shouldn't hinge on that. And that's going to just be another distraction.
And you can't write in that place.
Exactly. So I made the call to jump off social media. My US publisher very friendly reminded me I needed to get back on, which I don't know if they'd be happy me talking about that, but this is a reality. And so my wife was handling my Twitter and Instagram, and she just does not get Twitter. So it's clearly a different person. So I was like, I'll do the Twitter stuff, and she's doing the Instagram. And there's been like a couple of posts that were questionable. And I'm like, that's not me. I would never say that. So now I get copy approval, but I'm not scrolling.
Great.
Which is more important.
Well, we have not had that suggestion yet, and I'm really impressed by that. That's another way of doing it, not having to handle your own.
Yeah. Everyone says like scheduled posts and like scheduled times that you're going to, but it just doesn't work for me. I'm like, I'm too obsessive. Like I'll get on and then that becomes habit, and then the habit grows because it's easier than writing. And then all of a sudden I'm social media more than writing.
And I want to ask you about this writing, because you let slip when we were off discussing this off air before that you are already deep in the second book. In fact, you've probably got it under the belt.
The second book's better, by the way. I'm gonna say it and call it nice and early, and that's probably because I'm sick of Evie. But like the wife, the mother-in-law, publisher, agent, all like it more, and I like it more as well.
This is brilliant, and it's written and done and in the can before you're even having to worry about all the emotions from your first book coming out.
And I think that's why when I say it's better, I like it more.
Yeah.
That's obviously, subjective. But I think I like it more, and I think the readers who have read it like it more, is because it came out fully formed. There was no conveniently tying up plots or anything, and I'm not suggesting that happens in Evie. That's for the reader to decide, but I didn't have to work as hard as early days. I'm still working through edits, of course. But I didn't have to work as hard to get to make sure everything ties up and to make sure it kind of works. I think what it's about is more exciting. It's like a cult novel.
I'm excited.
I loved writing it.
So how quickly did this come out? What was the process?
So because I do the podcast, this is another great bit of advice. As soon as you get a book contract, as soon as you've got a break, as in like you're waiting for edits to come back or anything, just start writing. You have to get working on book two. Like I cannot stress that enough, because it's such a common complaint, the second book syndrome. Trying to write your second book when you're reading reviews about your first, you're touring or whatever with your first. So I was like particularly aware of this, and I was like, I have to write book two. So I had this great idea, and it just, I think it was like, so probably the very first draft would have been less than a month. Just like coffee.
Far out.
Like it was incredible. I don't think this will ever happen.
Yeah. Again, it's like that one time you get the gift, right?
Yeah. It just was like, everything fell into place. And I redrafted that probably half a dozen times over the next couple of months, which again is lightning quick. I was just like at the desk all day, every day. And then I emailed Pip, I go, this is amazing. I was just like,
you know, I love it.
I was particularly confident.
And what was her response to that?
She's like, yeah, send it through. So I sent it through. And then she goes, yeah, great, love it. Here's some suggestions. These are parts that are particularly weak. And I was wounded. I'm like, no, it's perfect.
It's perfect.
I had a bit of hubris because I wasn't trying to just get a contract from her. She was sort of, you know, I had a 2-book deal of Hashit, so I was bound to write it. So I felt like I had, but then like a day or two later, I'm like, she's right. Went away, redid it, and just worked and worked and worked, aware that it was going to go to the US and the UK agent as well. So I was like, okay, cool. All of a sudden, stakes are a bit higher, you know, really nail it. So I sent it back. Because it took her probably a month to get back to me, I think we're talking probably January, February this year.
Yeah.
I sent the second one away. And then I went to New York in April, and that's when she sent back her feedback. So she probably took her another month or so.
Yeah.
I think she probably enlisted another reader. But anyway, she sent through just a few minor things. It was on the phone. She goes, I'm not going to ruin your holiday. I know as soon as you get any feedback, you're going to start writing. So she sort of just emailed me, said, I read it. Da-da-da. There's certain things we'll talk about when you're back. I rang her when I got back, and she just sort of gave me really broad things for me to think about.
Posed as questions to you?
Questions, yeah, yep. Yeah. And so I guess by this stage, you know, that's sort of 6 months, and I reworked lots of parts of it. But I think as a writer, you know, I said this to a friend who's working on a novel. As a writer, I think you know what's wrong.
Yeah.
Deep down.
Yeah, you totally
You agree. Know what's wrong. If you don't know how to fix it, you have this sort of mental kind of flexibility to think that it's okay.
Mm.
Eventually someone's going to point it out and you're going to have to rework it. But when you're on that sort of high, when you're writing, everything's working, you're so prepared to ignore your gut feeling that it's not quite right and just sort of gloss over it. So I knew I had done that. And then so when she gave me this feedback, I just went and reworked it. And then she goes, cool, it's ready. I'll send it off to my publisher at Hashit. And she sent it off to the agents in other territories. And then she, like a month later, Robert goes, my publisher emailed and said, yep, by the way, I've accepted this. It's great.
Wow.
I think it's better than Navy.
Wow.
Bridge, who's one of the editors who I work with at Hashit, said that he's like, yeah, Bridge thinks it's better as well. Your Christmas present's going to be structural edits. So,
wow.
Which is like, I don't mind. I work all the time anyway.
Yeah.
The only thing is, like, I harass them, like my agent and my publisher, about everything all the time. So they're both going to be on leave for Christmas.
So your policy is constant emails, constant phone?
You know, it's embarrassing. Like, I'll ring publisher. I'll text Pippa and be like, hey, do you think I can get, like, more tattoos? Like, is that going to affect anything? Which is, like, bizarre, right?
What was the response to that question?
Lot of laughter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can see why.
But, like, I definitely overthink every single thing.
It's so revealing.
I'm like, I'm so sick of my hair. Because I used to shave my hair. I started as research for Call Me Evie. I shaved my head.
And then
I'm like, I had a shower. I'm like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And you get out and your hair's already dry. Like, it's the best. And I said to Pippa recently, can I shave my head? And she goes, maybe wait till book two, because all your author photos, all your like publicity photos you've got here, if you go to like a festival, for instance, people won't recognize you because they would have just seen your photos. And I was like, okay, that's fair. And that was like, you know, lucky I asked it because I was going to do it.
We have never had this level of disclosure of texting agents
podcast. I feel bad. Like, my wife's like embarrassed. She's like, please, like, before you send a text, give it an hour or so. And when she was away, like, she was in LA for work for a couple of weeks. I was like harassing them. I'm like, oh my God, normally I'd filter this through Paige. But
that is so great. I'm so glad to hear that. You've also given us an extraordinary amount of advice over our conversation. If you had to distill it down to one piece, there's a whole lot of both published writers and also people who are not yet published who are listening to the podcast. What do you tell them?
I mean, I think just because I'm still thinking about book two, I think I would say when it's working, just don't think. Just look at the screen and let it come. When it's flowing, when you've got like that spark, a little bit of magic happening, don't, like, it doesn't matter how crap you think it is. It doesn't matter how distracted you are. Just fill in the gaps, you know. It doesn't need to be poetic or anything when you're getting the words down. Just like, absolutely do not pick up your phone. Do not go clean the kitchen. Just keep going and then like designate a break. And on that break, this is what I do anyway. I don't do anything that I know could take longer than 10 or 15 minutes. So I'll go check the mail or I'll make a cup of tea. But that's the break, because they have a set time, and then do anything you can to kickstart that magic. I'll just say, because as I said, I'm kind of working with some ideas for book three, and I'm just like basically just writing at the moment to see if anything, you know, dislodges any ideas, like kind of fall out of my brain. I don't think there's a better feeling for a writer than when you're not actually thinking about what you're doing and you're just transposing what's in your head on the page and it's just flowing. So I think if you've got that and it's happening, do not do anything to break it, is all I'd say.
Love that piece of advice. Finally, JP, your favourite novel by a debut author?
It's so hard.
That's such a hard question, I know.
That I was obviously briefed on this and I kind of failed the brief. But I think the one thing that springs to mind is, there's two I've read recently, but the one that really stands out for me is Flames by Robbie Arnott. And I was fortunate enough to actually interview him, and he's a great guy. But I just think here's a guy that's doing the opposite to me. He's just writing in a way that is really artistic, really kind of like experimental. He's just writing what he'd like to read, basically. He's a writer's writer, but also I've recommended this to people who don't read a great deal of books, because it's funny. It's just like a combination, like this big amalgamation of so many different sort of styles. And at its core, there's just a fantastic story as well. So I think Flames is my favourite, certainly of the last year, is my favourite debut.
Fantastic. It's been on my TBR pile all year and it needs to go a little higher in there, I think.
It's incredible. Yeah, it's really good.
JP, it has been such a privilege to talk to you. Thank you for being so honest and candid with us. And
can you cut out the tattoo question? I'm like,
I cannot. That is staying in. That is gold. And we wish you so much good luck for Call Me Evie being released into the world.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. For more information on JP Pomari and to get your hands on a copy of his debut thriller, Call Me Evie, head to our show notes page where you'll find links to his website and lots of the things we chatted about. If you enjoyed the episode, let us and your mates know on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod, or by giving us a rating wherever you listen. Thanks for listening. And finally, we have some great news. We're very excited to let you know that The First Time Podcast is in the running for not one, but two upcoming awards. We've been selected as a finalist in Frankie Magazine's Good Stuff Awards. If you head to frankie.com.au and follow the links, you'll find all the amazing creatives who've reached the finals, and you can give us your vote for the People's Choice Award. You can also vote for us in the Australian Podcast Awards just until Feb 14. If you go to australianpodcastawards.com and search for The First Time Podcast, you can cast your vote. We'll put all the links in our show notes, and we thank you hugely in advance for your support. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe 80. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.